How's that for a dramatic entrance? What do you think? Oh, I like this crowd already. My name is Robert Hartwell, and on behalf of the San Francisco Opera, I'd like to welcome you to what promises to be a great evening. By and large, opera composers are specialists. If you look at the non-operatic works of, say, Wagner, Puccini, supremely unimportant. But Mozart was an exception. He excelled in everything: symphony, concerto, chamber music, and perhaps especially opera. In his not quite 36 years on this earth, he composed in all 22 operas, the first of which at the age of 11. And by the time he was 12, he was a seasoned veteran with four operas under his belt. Age 12. You know, one of the joys of being a college professor is tormenting my students with these stories of miraculous children. Where else can you make 19-year-olds already feel like they're a failure? But joking aside, all of Mozart's mature operas are masterpieces, and they have never been out of the repertoire. 1791, Mozart's last year, and for him, an unusually busy one. He was emerging from a protracted slump in popularity, and thankfully, commissions were once again pouring in, including commissions for two very different operas, La Clemenza di Tito and our opera tonight, The Magic Flute. The Magic Flute is a very particular kind of opera known as a Singspiel. And in a Singspiel, you have spoken dialogue with musical numbers interspersed. Think like a Broadway musical, for example. In tonight's innovative production, however, we're going to have animated sequences taking the place of that spoken dialogue. The Magic Flute is also different in that it was not written for an aristocratic audience, but rather for a popular one, in collaboration with a versatile man of the theater named Emanuel Schikaneder. And I use that word versatile advisedly. In addition to being an impresario, he was also a dramatist, actor, singer, dancer, even a composer. And as such, ran a highly successful popular theater in Vienna. Schikaneder's opera troupe specialized in what he called magic operas. And these were operas with fairy tale plots and lots of lavish special effects. Well, unfortunately, then as now, fame in the entertainment world is fleeting. After riding high for a number of years, the public gradually lost interest in Schikaneder's magic operas, and he died in 1812, insane, impoverished, and forgotten. But he managed just a small slice of immortality by having collaborated with Mozart on the Magic Flute. It premiered on September 30th, 1791, and for those in the audience that opening night, they might well have been puzzled by the cover of their program. Illustrated as it was with these exotic-looking symbols, pyramids, five-pointed stars, arches bathed in light, I'm sure some of the patrons thought, well, I guess the opera takes place in ancient Egypt or some such. But for a select few in the audience that night, they knew very well what those symbols were. Those were the symbols of the ancient and venerable order of Freemasons, a secret society devoted to, among other things, egalitarian ideals and freedom of thought. And for our patrons that night, they were then treated to still further surprises. The overture, that orchestral music that starts an opera, is strangely interrupted right in the middle, with three chords played three times. And as the opera unfolded, I'm sure they noticed, as you probably will tonight, the ubiquity of the number three. There's three ladies, there's three boys, there's three doors. There's even three flats in the key signature. Now, in number symbolism, three is often seen as the number of time, as in past, present, future, or the number of existence, birth, life, death. But for our purposes tonight, three plays a central role in Masonic rituals. And indeed, the plot itself, at first blush, a rather convoluted fairy tale, begins to make sense when seen through the eyes of Freemasonry, with its central themes of love, striving for betterment, and not least, its reenactment of Masonic rituals. And so it seems Mozart and Schikaneder have given us a Masonic opera, which I think begs the question, why? Particularly when there were compelling reasons why not? It was, after all, a secret society, and with their radical ideas, I think they were wise to stay off the radar of emperors and their secret police. And in fact, upon initiation, Freemasons took the following oath: I conceal these secrets under penalty of having my throat slit or my tongue pulled out of my head. In fact, in 1971, a book came out entitled Mozart's Death, in which the authors put forward the theory that the Freemasons killed Mozart for revealing their secrets in the Magic Flute. I think you'll agree, made to order for today's conspiracy theorists, don't you think? No reputable scholar takes this idea seriously, but still, why a Masonic opera? And I think it goes like this. Mozart and Schikaneder were both Freemasons, and their beloved Freemasonry was in very real danger of extinction. In the latter part of the 18th century, European monarchs were becoming quite nervous about secret societies, and not without cause. Radical ideas like democracy and so forth were in the air, just the kind of radical ideas espoused by the Freemasons. And if our nervous monarchs needed any proof, they had only to point to those rabble-rousing Americans, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, all Freemasons. And look what happened there. And things only got worse for our poor, beleaguered monarchs. In 1789, Emperor Leopold II could only watch in horror at the unfolding events in France, as his counterpart, Louis XVI, and his bride, Marie Antoinette, were, to put it politely, about to be made a foot shorter. And so these nervous monarchs decided to just say no to secret societies in general, and the Freemasons in particular. And I believe that Mozart and Schikaneder wanted to portray to the world the values of their quickly vanishing Freemasonry. So let's turn now to the music. That overture, which I had mentioned previously as being strangely interrupted in the middle, is nonetheless one of Mozart's best and most ebullient opera overtures. It's structured like a round. Think of the children's song, Row, Row, Row Your Boat. That is, we have a melody, it's then repeated a few seconds later, and again, all the while, layered on top of each other, and we'll hear that in just a moment. Looked at through the lens of Freemasonry, we might see the overture as the voices of humanity gradually coming together, seeking a new dawn. So let's hear the overture. Can we hear example one, please? First theme. Second statement. And third time. And a fourth time. By the way, Mozart borrowed that melody from his rival, Muzio Clementi. Mozart, who never had a good thing to say about his rivals, described Clementi as lacking taste, a robot, and like all Italians, a charlatan. But seeing as Mozart is the one who swiped the melody, I'll let you decide who is the charlatan here. This wide-ranging fairy tale gave Mozart an unusually broad palette, allowing him to include something for everybody. We have animal scenes for the children. We have simple, catchy tunes for those in the cheap seats. And we have sophisticated, virtuosic arias for the connoisseurs. So let's begin by sampling one of those simple, catchy tunes as delivered by one of our most memorable characters, the birdcatcher, Papageno. He is a mildly buffoonish character who begins by bragging about his birdcatching prowess, but we quickly realize what he's actually hoping to catch is a wife. As befits the character, the music is simple and folk tune-like. And the aria serves a couple of functions within the opera. Of course, to entertain and amuse, but Papageno also represents the common humanity enduring trials on their path to betterment. And by the way, the role would have been played by Schikaneder himself, who specialized in these comic roles. Could we hear example two, please, Papageno? Another example of this very accessible music can be heard in the Act One duet between Princess Pamina and, again, our birdcatcher. Again, very tuneful, but in this case also exquisitely beautiful. And again, looked at through the lens of Freemasonry, we have royalty and commoner coming together as equals. Could we hear example three, please? So now, let's turn, as promised, to one of those arias for the connoisseurs, which takes us to one of the most famous moments in the entire operatic repertoire, the aria Hell's Vengeance Boils My Heart, or just simply the Queen of the Night aria. Here, the Queen of the Night first cajoles and then threatens her daughter to kill her rival Sarastro. She says to her daughter, if Sarastro doesn't die by your hands, you are no longer my daughter. What we have here, in addition to bad parenting, is a spectacular and spectacularly difficult aria to sing. It's very high, it's very fast, and when pulled off correctly, is an absolute tour de force. By the way, Mozart wrote this aria specifically for his sister-in-law, Josepha Hofer. The always generous Mozart described her as lazy, gross, perfidious, and cunning as a fox. Nonetheless, she must have possessed a remarkable and remarkably flexible voice. Can we hear example 4, Queen of the Night aria? Just as an aside here, the practice of writing arias for specific singers was common in Mozart's day and beyond, and I just want to share with you my favorite example provided by the ever-witty Gioachino Rossini, composer of The Barber of Seville. On one occasion, he auditioned the mezzo-soprano and discovered, in his words, she had only one note that didn't sound too bad. And so he proceeded to write an entire aria consisting of that one note. The orchestra weaves in and out, doing all the work. It's brilliant, it's hilarious, it's a minor masterpiece. I encourage you to look it up, Rossini, one note aria. In tonight's innovative production, we have an array of percussion instruments not usually heard in the magic flute. And we at the San Francisco Opera thought it might be fun just to sample a couple of those for you right now. And here to help us are our percussionist, Patty Nimi, Victor Avienko, and our timpanist, John Burkhardt. So let's start with the, yes, let's give them a round of applause. So let's begin with the thunder sheet, which is used in other places, such as the entrance of the Queen of the Night. We also have timpani with tuning change by a foot pedal. This is used for the bomb explosion in Act Two. We also have a wind machine used for the storm near the end of Act Two. And then the Chinese cymbal also used in the bomb explosion in Act Two. How about another round of applause for Patty, Victor, and John? You know, something struck me as I was putting this talk together, and that is, it's one thing to write a great opera by setting a great story to great music. It's quite another to elevate a story full of hidden and obscure meanings into that same realm of greatness. And the magic flute is assuredly great. That might have been something that Mozart, and only Mozart, could have pulled off. The Magic Flute was the greatest success of his career. It was sold out night after night after night. It should have been and would have been a turning point in his career, but he would be dead in 2 months. And indeed, on December 5th, 1791, at 55 minutes past midnight, Mozart's great spirit left his frail body. It would take many decades for humanity to realize just what that loss would mean. But Mozart's great contemporary, Joseph Haydn, knew very well what it meant. Upon hearing of Mozart's death, he said the following: "Posterity will not see such a talent for 100 years. To which I would add, posterity has not seen such a talent in 200 years. Once again, my name is Robert Hartwell. Thank you so much for joining me. Please enjoy the show. Thank you.